forward waiting. Maybe you are as well. So why don't we go ahead and just dive in? I think we've got as many as we're going to round up at this point. All right, so my name's Chris Hallam. I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. And basically what that means is if there's any security technology inside Windows, whether it's BitLocker, AppLocker, things that are more at the kernel level, things like ALSR, DAP, you know, pretty much anything that's there to keep Windows secure against threats is something that kind of falls under my domain. And so today we're going to talk about what's new in blue. And the organization of the presentation is we're going to start with a kind of an overview of what we've accomplished in Windows 8. So we'll just kind of overview very quickly the features that are most relevant, most impactful. We'll talk about some results that we've got. We've received some pretty interesting telemetry data that shows the progress that we've made, which is really substantial when you compare it versus 7 and 8. And then we'll talk about how some threats in the landscape are changing. And then we'll get into the real meat, which is, you know, what's new. So with that, when it comes to Windows 8 security, our goal from the very beginning was to deliver the most substantial set of security improvements that we've ever delivered in a single release. We staffed accordingly. I think the security team might be 40-50% bigger than it was on previous releases. So we brought a lot more resources to bear, and that, of course, allowed us to set some big goals. One of those goals was to deliver groundbreaking malware resistance. And with that, we're able to eliminate entire classes of malware. If you're familiar with bootkits and rootkits, things that are persistent and dig themselves fairly deep in the system, those have all but been eradicated from the system. Bootkits are dead with the advent of UEFI technology, which is a hardware technology that allows a secure startup of Windows or Linux or whatever operating system. There's no way a bootkit can sit there in between hardware and a desired operating system loader. There is an attack vector still. If you sign an operating system loader with Microsoft's signature or Linux's signature, then you could defeat that system, but that would require acquiring a certificate, which has happened, obviously. Right? We all know about Flame. So that is a potential threat, but we got some technology in blue that can address that as well. So another thing we've done, probably the most important thing, I think, was the fact that we made investments in ALSR and DEP, which are technologies that make it very difficult for a vulnerability to result in a successful exploit. We had pretty good technology in Windows 7, and even with 7, we started to see people kind of divert their attention to other ways of attacking the system. They're looking at social engineering as a more likely attack path than trying to find a way to exploit the system because it was pretty hard on 7. But people still did it, right? We've seen security patches, obviously, and we've even seen some exploits. So with Windows 8, what we did is we invested in DEP and ALSR to an extent that we think it's very unlikely that people can exploit the system without a very sophisticated team, right? And when I say team, I'm not talking about anonymous. I'm talking about probably more of a state-sponsored type of base of talent might be able to find ways to work around that system. And I'm not saying that's the only way, but the bar's high, right? It's a totally different level of IQ required to get around the systems. So anyway, when you net all of that out, pretty big improvements there. And I think groundbreaking is a pretty fair marketing term to declare on it. When it came to protecting sensitive data, our goal was to make sure that BitLocker encryption was probably one of the easiest options to provision to a PC. One thing that all encryption vendors share is it takes a long time to encrypt drives. It can take hours on end, depending on hardware. And it's just a big challenge. And for this reason, people typically only encrypt their laptops. Sometimes they do to their desktops, but very rarely. And I find that data center servers are pretty much never encrypted. And it's all about how much time that it takes. So our goal with 8 was to make it super fast, super easy to encrypt devices. And we achieved that goal in a couple ways. One, with USDISC space-only encryption in BitLocker, you can actually have a 10, a 20, a 30x, or even higher performance increase as you provision the encryption, because we no longer encrypt the whole drive. We only encrypt data as we're writing it, right? Why encrypt half a terabyte of zeros, right? There's nothing there. So we encrypt only the data it's being written, if that's the model you choose. You can encrypt the whole drive if you want, but most people are moving towards this USDISC space-only encryption. So that's a huge improvement. The other thing is SEDs. So many of you have heard of self-encrypting drives. Those are a great thing, onboard encryption. So that gives you instantaneous encryption. It's actually a lot like USDISC space-only encryption in some respects because it's encrypting as it's writing. The challenge there, though, is that SEDs did not have an ideal management scenario when it came to keys. And so we don't support them. We didn't support them in 7. We don't support them in 8. But the IHVs have come up with a new generation of SSDs called encrypted hard drives, which are just starting to show up on the marketplace. They are physically identical to an SSD. They're Opal standards. They meet a lot of the ISO standards. The things that's different is how the keys are managed. And the way the key management works makes it very easy for Windows to manage those keys and secure the drive. So really fundamentally the same, except they work on Windows, and we fully support those. And that gives you basically instantaneous encryption, right? So we're moving into a world where the notion of like going through the labor of encrypting PCs is really kind of going away. We also included a variation of BitLocker called device encryption in Windows RT and also in Windows Phone 8. This is the same technology. It's built on BitLocker technology. What makes it different than BitLocker is it's not manageable. So if you want to centrally store keys, or you want to control how it's configured, you want to go from 128 encryption to 256, you need BitLocker to kind of do that. But device encryption with 128 is obviously very secure. And it's automatic, which is pretty nice, and very nice for bring your own device scenarios. When it comes to modern access control, virtual smart cards were one of the big investments there. Virtual smart cards give us a multi-factor authentication option that's electronically provisionable. What we do is a certificate is issued to the PC, it's secured with the device's TPM chip, and then we model it in our UI, well, in our device manager, and in a way in the UI, as a physical smart card that's always got a reader plugged in and always has a card plugged in. So if you're using virtual smart cards, you look in device manager, you'll see these things always there. The beauty there is my device is the smart card, and I don't need to bring a second thing. And so it's always there, it's always connected, and it's electronically provisionable, which makes it very easy to manage and maintain. This is part of our strategy, incidentally, to move away from passwords. So you've heard lots of things. You probably read the Matt Honan article in Wired about, you know, kill the password. He's absolutely right. Passwords are increasingly problematic, and our goal is to get rid of them. The problem is they are so deeply ingrained in our systems and the way we behave that we can't just turn the lights off on that one. So virtual smart cards are a first step, and then we're going to talk about step two today, and then there will be things that follow in the future. But I think when you see these two things, you may be able to predict where things are going. And I won't be able to tell you where they're going, but I'm going to let you do the math, and I'm sure many of you will figure it out. When it comes to securing access to resources, you're familiar with how we do that. We have an object, a relationship with a list of users who have access, and somebody has to keep that list up to date. It doesn't scale, hugely problematic. Most people have cumulative access with an enterprise. I've been at Microsoft for almost 17 years. I still have access to the things I had 15 years ago, even though I shouldn't. But nobody can keep up with this. And so dynamic access control creates a condition where we move from static lists to dynamic rules that operate on properties in Active Directory. And so as long as your reporting manager or the projects you're working on or your department and these types of things are up to date, you'll be able to build access control policy rules around those, and that's what will give you access, is the things that are about you rather than you, which would be that security principle. So that gives you the kind of the overview on where we've been. I hope that some of you at least learned a few things there, but let's talk about the big hero of the Windows release, right? We delivered quite a bit of technology there, and as I mentioned, it was the biggest release, but the hero really was our malware resistance work. And so in the Trustworthy Computing Group, which is an organization at Microsoft, they deliver this report called the Security Intelligence Report. Version 14 came out in April, and they gave us the first evidence of how well those investments in malware resistance had paid off. We divide this report into two things just before we get into the details. We take a look at PCs that are protected with an anti-malware solution, and we also looked at PCs that don't have an anti-malware solution running. Now, Windows 8 has a built-in anti-malware solution, and we have, as you'll see, we have some PCs that don't have an anti-malware solution running. So the question is why? The reason why is when people move to a third-party alternative and it's on a temporary trial basis and it expires, which happens most of the time. I think it might be over 40% of anti-malware solutions have expired or are actually not doing anything anymore. That's why that number is the way it is these PCs have an anti-malware solution, it's not Defender and it's not running anymore. But at any rate, so that's kind of how the report's organized, and it's based on per thousand. So for every 1,000 PCs that we're getting telemetry data from, when you're not protected, you're gonna have 2.7 of those PCs are gonna have some sort of infection on it. When we compare that to, and that's on Windows 8, when we compare it to Windows 7, that number increases to about three times. So even without an anti-malware solution, Windows 8 is dramatically more resistant to malware. And the reasons why are probably a number of things. One of the reasons is probably ALSR in depth. As I mentioned earlier, we've increased the entropy of ALSR. It's far more random in memory. It's far more difficult to find places to put your malicious payloads. I think that that's part of the factor, or the calculus there. The other thing is trusted boot and secure boot from UEFI prevent these persistent low-level infections. And so those are some of the elements. There's probably other factors, but I would credit those features as probably being the most likely contributors. When we compare it to, I'm not going to cover Vista, but when we compare it to XP, you're looking at, like, what is that? That's roughly a little over five times more likely to be infected. Now, where things get really interesting is when we move to a device that is protected. So we move down to 0.2, so we have this dramatic drop, not surprising. But when we compare it to Windows 7, six times less, so kind of comparable versus the unprotected mode, protected mode. But when you compare it versus XP, it's 21 times less likely. So if you're still a person or you know somebody who's still running XP, there's a good reason to move forward, right? I mean, it's like a no-brainer, right? It's so much safer. And XP, by incidentally, is going to become a huge target, because when we stop patching that thing, all it takes is one more zero day, and we'll never patch it, and everybody will use that again and again and again and again. It'll be interesting to see what happens to devices that are running XP after it starts getting patched, because even if you have an anti-malware solution, it's going to be too late, right? You're going to get the first zero day, the PC will be rooted, and the anti-malware solution will never be able to clean it up. So that's disaster waiting to happen. And luckily, most people have moved off already. So that's where we're at with 8. And when we looked at things during the product cycle, we actually noticed some changes in the threat landscape even before we shipped 8. Right? So after the plan was stamped and we were committed to what we were doing, we couldn't really change our plan. We started to see some shifts in the types of attacks. And so some of these shifts are almost seismic in nature. We'll kind of go into the details here. But really what we have is what we've been doing for the last 10 years is been dealing with an evolution of threats. Right? Threat comes out, we mitigate, another one comes out. It's just this hamster wheel. It's an arms race with these things. And so during the Windows 8 cycle, we started to see more of like revolutionary types of things, where we saw some very, very aggressive attacks. You've read about them in the news. Things that were definitely not evolutionary. They were more kind of on the revolution. And so what we see now, the evidence we collect, we have tons of telemetry data. I mean, the reality is there's really two types of enterprises. There's those who've been hacked, and they've admitted it. Maybe they've gone public about it. Maybe not. But they know that they've been hacked. And then there's all these other people who just don't realize they've been hacked. And that really is a true statement. I know it sounds like we're, you know, playing into fear, but that's kind of where we're at, because the threats that are out there are pretty aggressive compared to what we saw maybe 5 years ago when we were still kind of defining the Windows 8 plan. So there are threats that are very familiar. Those are the evolutionary threats, right? The things that, you know, you're almost predictable where they'll go, right? We patch here, they move over here, right? It's this constant battle, right? And then there's these new modern threats. They're moving away. For instance, I think malware will continue to be an issue, but I think that people are maybe moving more towards identity theft, right? They're looking at certificates and stealing certs as a way of getting into a system. And, you know, typically people deploy malware to a system so they can get the identities, right? And now they are attacking the identities because the malware problem is getting pretty cleaned up, as our stats showed. So when we look at the familiar versus modern threats, right, we're familiar with script kiddies, and we're familiar with cybercrime, anonymous, and these types. We now are dealing with cyber espionage, and we're dealing with cyber warfare and cyber sabotage, and on and on. We're familiar with cyber criminals. Well, now the modern is state-sponsored actors, right? And these state-sponsored actors aren't attacking the United States government necessarily, or a European government. They're actually attacking private businesses. Sometimes in the interest of dealing with government issues, but sometimes just to acquire IP. And these space-sponsored actors also have unlimited resources, right? You know, a small group of anonymous guys, they have to pay the bills, right? These people are paid a lot of money, and they have no budgets. We've tried to solve problems in software forever, but we know that software can be defeated. So with Windows 8, you saw us invest a lot in hardware. We had UEFI, TPM became a big central part of our story. So hardware-rooted trust is the modern way. So that actually was kind of delivered in Windows 8. But our devices that people are using need to catch up to that modern threat, because most people are not running Windows 8 hardware yet. The approach of securing the perimeter is something that people have done. Well, that's not good enough. You have to assume you've been breached, and you have to protect every layer within it, right? To the client, to the resources within it, on and on. If you're thinking about perimeter defense, You're missing the boat. We know this is true because we can all point to what happened at the Bushehr nuclear facility in Iran. They have an air gap network, and guess what? Somebody walks Stuxnet inside that perimeter. So you have to assume you've been breached and protected at all levels. Attacks in Fortune 500. People tell me all the time, I'm a small business, I don't need to worry about this. That's not true anymore. They're attacking all people, all sectors, users, people who work for Fortune 500, small businesses, et cetera. The familiar is, I hope I don't get hacked, but the modern is, you will, and so it's really about mitigation. So here's a couple of quotes, and then we're going to move into the meat of the presentation. This is interesting from S-Secure. This is in response to Flame. What they basically said here is that security products that you're using are not designed to deal with modern threats. They can't protect you from the digital equivalent of SEAL Team 6. So that's the modern threat. Anonymous is not SEAL Team 6, although they're very talented, right? They've done some amazing types of things that are surprising. But SEAL Team 6 are the people who got Stuxnet. They're the people who did Flame and some of the other malware out there. So that's what we're dealing with there. Now, what about businesses? Well, Verizon does a great report every year, and look what they said. They said, these people who think that they're too small to be a target, they have data that proves otherwise. So if you're a small business and you're thinking you don't need to worry about this, you are wrong. Last pitch here, this is from last week. Many of you probably read the article from the Washington Post or maybe some of the veritals of it because everybody blogged about it. But of course, some of our most secret defense systems have been compromised. Plans on the F-35, our missile defense system, a number of others have all been compromised. And we know who did it, we think at least. And what I thought was interesting is Lockheed made another statement. And this is interesting. It says, basically, they're spending more time protecting their subcontractors, their employees, the vendors, and their supply chain than they are to protect themselves. Because they know that if you can compromise somebody in your supply chain, person building nuts and bolts for an airplane, you can probably get on to the inside of the big fish. They're using the people outside to get into the bigger company. So with that, there will be two types of companies, of course. There will both be those who adapt and then those who don't. And so the stakes are pretty high. And so with Windows 8.1, we're going to deliver a long list of security capabilities to address some of these modern threats. Malware resistance was the big hero in our last release. Modern access control is going to be the big one this time because we know that we're seeing a lot of energy shifting away from trying to create malware to trying to compromise things like public key infrastructure and these types of things. So that's where the modern threats will be, things like the password and things I mentioned earlier. So let's kind of dive in to what's going on. So TPM is central in our modern access control story because that's how we're going to protect identities. And so TPM has been a technology we've had for quite a while. It's used by BitLocker in Windows 7 and in Windows 8. We used it for BitLocker, we used it for virtual smart cards, and we used it for a long list of other capabilities. The challenge with TPM is it's not on all devices, but that all changes pretty much starting on June 4th with Intel's Haswell processor that they just announced the release date for, which is later in the week. Haswell will ship with a technology called Platform Trust Technology, which will enable the delivery of a firmware-based TPM solution. So basically all new processors, whether they're Atom processors, which have PTT today, or i5, 6, 7s, they're going to have PTT. And of course, those are targeted at consumers. And so now we're going to see TPM is going to be in pretty much all consumer devices starting almost right away. So this is going to be great. And it's going to be very important for BYOD because we need this technology to protect those devices that you really don't have full fidelity management of. In 2015, we will make it a certification requirement that all devices ship with TPM. So starting, you know, about a year from now, a little over that obviously, you will see every device has to have it to get a sticker. So that's our direction, and this is going to change everything. I would foresee a day when you connect to your bank that they would provision a virtual smart card to your device and use that to authenticate you rather than a username and password. So with pervasiveness of TPM, we can have that type of secure banking scenarios and on and on. So that's TPM. So let's go into modern access control. One of the big areas is we're going to have a first-class biometrics experience. So we've had biometrics in Windows for several versions, but it's really been a framework. We've had APIs, and it really required third parties to add software in order to complete the experience, and the reality is it really never took off. There are some organizations that use it, and then there are most don't. I couldn't give you a percentage, but if it was If it was more than 20% of the customers out there using biometrics, I would be extremely surprised. I can't imagine it being that high. So it's very, very low percentage. So the opportunity, as I mentioned, is to try to get away from passwords, and biometrics is going to be one of the next steps to get there. Now, full disclosure, biometrics is a layer on top of a password, so they're not going away yet. But this is the next step in a series of steps that we're going to take. So we'll still have passwords, but what biometrics enables us to do is it would enable IT to move away from user-facing passwords. You could have extremely long, complex passwords being generated by IT, things that would never be remembered or used on a regular basis, and then you could use the biometrics as a front end. So I think a lot of organizations will use that as a stopgap. They will provision extremely complex passwords that are maybe more than 10, 15 or 20 characters that will be, effectively unguessable and unhackable, and then they'll use the biometric identity on top of it. And then you would go through a recovery experience to use that complex password if you needed it for a certain experience. But that's, that's just an IT option that they could choose. But at any rate, what we want to do in 8.1.1 is we want to include all of the software necessary to complete the biometric experience, and we want to make sure that it's the best experience, right? We want to make it such a good experience that you would be crazy to use a password because it creates so much friction in the experience. And I'll show you in a minute how that can be achieved. So when it comes to biometrics, there's many options, right? There's facial, there's fingerprint, there's all sorts of other options. And so we are optimizing for fingerprint biometrics. Now, we've made investments in Windows 8 that will make it better for other options, but those other options are very difficult, right? Facial recognition with a camera, even a high-resolution camera, is not secure enough. We need something more along the lines of Kinect-type technology that can detect liveness, three-dimensional types of views to really make a camera work, and that doesn't fit inside a laptop. So the best choice with what we can do today is with a fingerprint technology, and there's a number of different readers. There's optical and a couple of others. Capacitive readers are going to be the technology choice moving forward, and the reason why is we've all heard about cases where people have faked up fingerprints, right? So there was an article about 6 months ago down in Brazil. There was a group of doctors, and there were five of them, and they all created silicone imprints of their fingers, and basically during a certain shift at the hospital they worked at, three of them would show up, and they would sign in their buddies who are not showing up to work that day, and they would go watch football and maybe drink cerveza, and they would get paid anyway. And this is actually right from the case, and so you can see they had these, I wouldn't call them sophisticated, but they're very real-looking fingerprints. Those type of things aren't going to work with modern technology, and so modern readers are already actually present in today's devices. So if you have a Lenovo device, you have a fingerprint reader, and that actually has the concept of liveness detection. So this technology, this hack doesn't work there, right? So we already have technology to beat it. But there's something in addition you need to do what we consider modern fingerprint reading, and that's with a touch-based device. Rather than being a swipe-based device, when you have to swipe your finger, it should be a touch, and it should take less than a second to recognize the imprint. It should be able to detect the difference between the imprint of someone who's dead, as this one is. This is actually a fingerprint as it looks when somebody is deceased, versus one that's alive, right? So moisture in your body actually changes the way a fingerprint looks. And liveness detection also has many other ways of analyzing the liveness of an individual, electrocardiograms, moisture. There's a bunch of other types of ways to analyze it. So this is an example of a reader. These type of readers, at least the touch surface in the middle, you're going to see those added to actual devices. And I have one here that I can show you here in a minute. So, as I mentioned, we've completed the user experience for biometrics. There's a couple of things we've done. The enrollment experience that you used to have to go to third parties for is now baked into Windows. It works for existing swipe readers as well as the new touch devices. So the enrollment experience is first class. It's in the box, and it works real well. I'll show you that in a minute. The next thing is we've made sure that all authentication experiences, regardless of where you're at, in the browser, in sign-in for Windows, VPN, wherever the authentication needs to happen, 100% of those can be take advantage of a biometric verification. We've also added the ability to do what we're calling touch to buy. So when you go to the Windows Store or Xbox Live, you'll be able to use your biometric identity as a way to verify the purchase. So we're now seeing it in e-commerce. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to enable you to protect resources with biometrics. So today, when you start log onto your PC, you have 100%, you have access to 100% of the applications and data on that device because you're using your identity. Well, a lot of people share their devices. And one scenario is I log into my device, I'm driving somewhere, and I hand my Surface to my kid, and I've got, you know, maybe my banking app sitting there, and you know, I trust Avery, she's only 7, but my 15-year-old, he might want to see what's going on in my bank account, and so he might be able to load the app and maybe take a peek at what's going on. And so what we have added is we've added an API that allows the app basically to gate access to the application with a biometric verification. We've also had the ability to have certain functions with apps within apps gated with biometric verification. So you can imagine selling a piece of stock, right, or moving money from one account to the next, right? With a touch-based device, you have a very frictionless experience, right? You go into the app and touch to verify that you want to make that transaction. So it doesn't get in the way like a password would. You can even hide confidential information on a PC as well with this type of technology. So let's do a couple of quick demos, and I'll show you kind of what the new experiences on a Windows 8.1 device looks like. So what we have here is a device. It's a prototype device that was sent to us for fingerprint cards. We have Charles Ning from Fingerprint Cards actually here, and he'll join us at Q&A if we have any questions on it. But this is a prototype device, and what we really want to show you is the touch surface, which it's kind of hard to tell exactly what it looks like. I wonder if I can bring it into the camera a little closer, get it to autofocus. I don't know, there's not enough light, but basically you get the idea. What we're looking at here is about a 10 by 10 sensor, so it's very, very small. So it's not much bigger than the fingerprint readers that you have that are swiped, just a little bit bigger, and they can be down to about 9.6 by 9.6 millimeters. So these are very tiny, and they can be put anywhere on a device. And so we'll see that touch sensor added to laptops, tablets, keyboards, all-in-one devices, all the places you'd expect, you'll see this technology arriving there. Now, typically, this is a very, very expensive part, and the cost of these are going to be dramatically less because for the first time, touch technology will be delivered at scale. It's not going to be in the hundreds of thousands. It's going to be in the hundreds of millions, and so it's going to drive down the cost. So a device like this is very expensive today, but it's going to be affordable in the devices you buy down the road. So let's go ahead and plug this reader in to my device here, and then we'll do a couple demos with it. Switch to number 2. Okay, so we're signed in. So I'm at the Windows sign-in, and one thing that's nice about the sign-in experience when you're using a fingerprint reader is when I give my fingerprint identity to the device, it's going to figure out which profile I want to log into. So I don't have to raise the lock screen up, find my profile, maybe type my username. It's just going to take my identity, and it's going to go, that's the profile for you. So you notice I put my finger on that surface for maybe less than a second, and it instantly logged me into the appropriate account. So it's very fast and obviously a lot more reliable than a password, which usually takes me about 2 tries, and on Monday morning it takes me 4 tries on a Monday morning maybe. So they're super fast and really, I think, enhance the overall experience. I've got a demo app here, and this is taking advantage of that API I mentioned. So when I want to load, let's say, my stock trading app here, you'll notice that this app is taking advantage of the API. It's asking for my biometric verification to sign in, and now I've loaded the app. Now that I'm here, I might be able to do all sorts of things, and in the case of maybe making a large sale, like sell all shares, I can again hook into that API and ask for biometric identification. So this whole demo with all 3 times that I've logged in actually took about the same amount of time that logging on with a password did, actually, if you add it all up in some cases. So this really gives you a frictionless experience. And what's going to be great is, I think, when you add this type of capability on top of, you know, sensitive apps like finance apps without friction, you're going to increase the overall security that you have. So this is pretty cool technology. Let's go ahead and go back to our presentation. Oh, I didn't show fingerprint enrollment. Let me start again here. Okay, so fingerprint enrollment. So if I want to enroll a finger, I go into settings, change PC settings, and you'll see some new UI that most people haven't been able to see yet here. I go into accounts, sign in options, and I can add another fingerprint option. What's going to do here is before I add another fingerprint, what did we do? We hooked our own API. Let's verify that it's actually the user who has access to this device before we add a new fingerprint. So I've now verified my identity. It knows it's me. And now I'm going to use my middle finger rather than my index. I've now enrolled another identity. If I had a swipe-based device, it'd probably take me about 8 times. So it's going to need to take multiple images of that imprint to really verify so that it can be reliable. So with the touch-based device, it does 2 tries. Once that really probably is accurate 100% of the time, but one more just to make sure that nothing went wrong. So anyway, so this is a really awesome way of signing in and authenticating. Okay, so let's go to our next section here. So multi-factor authentication, we talked about bring your own devices. We talked about virtual smart cards, and as I mentioned earlier, virtual smart cards don't work very well on bring your own devices. It really required a domain joined device to be able to provision that card and that certificate out to the device. We've added API support that enables provisioning of virtual smart cards to non-domain joined devices. So now that TPM is pervasive, now that we have the non-domain join story there, we know that virtual smart cards are going to go mainstream pretty quickly. So let me show you a quick way of enrolling. So who here is enrolled in a virtual smart card, maybe using Forefront Identity Manager or something else? Okay. Well, it takes some time, and it's a bit complex. So maybe this demo will only impress those who've gone through that pain. But we'll show it anyway. Oops, wrong device here. All right. So I have another test app here. So what we have here, this is just a demo app. This is not something that we're shipping. We're shipping an SDK and APIs, and so companies like Interseed and other people who do PKI and identity management would take advantage of these APIs, but this is just a way of enrolling in it. If you were to use a Forefront Identity Manager, what would happen is you would go to a website, you would log in, you would have to have a smart card reader, and you would have to put your card in, and you would go through maybe 5 or 6 minutes of enrolling, getting it prepared, and then eventually you'd get your smart card. And it just takes a long time. With this, it's very, very simple. So what I'm going to do here is use my biometric identity to validate who I am. I'm going to provide the PIN that I'm going to use for this particular card. Corporate policy requires 8. I should have known that as the security guy. Let's see. Okay. And so now, with just a couple of keystrokes, I've got my virtual smart card. It still takes some time to get the card, but it's now going to happen, and it will be there. Just to show you where they are, if I go into settings, let's see here. Oh my goodness. Well, I'm not going to be able to show it to you because it's moved between builds. So this is the latest build that we were able to show, and it's actually moved since the last time. So maybe it's under accounts. No. Anyway, I'm sorry I can't show it. But anyway, you'll just have to believe me that the virtual smart card has been provisioned to the device. So let's go ahead and go back to our presentation here. And let's talk about probably one of the other most relevant areas in the release. So as I mentioned earlier, public key infrastructure is probably in the crosshairs of people. Now that it's difficult to hack on Windows, we think that they're going to go after that. We have a whole initiative around increasing the trustworthiness of identities and the public key infrastructure itself. So you may be familiar with some of the famous hacks on public key infrastructure, and I've listed 4 here. So DigiNotar, if you're familiar with that situation, they're a certificate authority. Somebody called up DigiNotar and said they were representative from Google and Yahoo and a number of others. They provided enough information about who they were that they convinced DigiNotar to issue private keys of Google, Yahoo, and a number of other companies. And then from there, they set up a web server. They then deep poisoned DNS on the internet, and they redirected traffic to their own websites, and they deployed malware and stole identities and did all sorts of terrible things. So in this case, they were using authentic certs because they tricked human beings. So that's a pretty scary thing, because we can't get rid of the human beings making decisions on how to provision these things. But this is one of the attack vectors. Stuxnet was a different scenario altogether. This is some, they actually broke into somebody who had their private keys, and they physically stole them because they had inside knowledge on how they were being protected within, I think it was Realtek and a couple of other companies. So those are stolen certs. Another example is fake certs. So in the case of Flame, they used a collision attack to basically create a certificate that looked authentic if you didn't analyze it closely. But if you analyze it closely, you'd realize that it was hacked. But the way the PKI system works and the way we validate the authenticness of certificates, we don't look at that level. And so they had basically what looked like real Microsoft certificates, even though they were not. So those are examples of really kind of public scenarios. And then we have another scenario where the identities of devices and users that were provisioned by organizations, right? So maybe at Microsoft, I have a certificate that represents my identity. There's actually a tool called Mimikatz where you can actually export certificates even though they're marked as non-exportable in Windows. So Windows has something called a key storage provider. Key storage provider is where we store those certificates and we protect them. But if you can compromise Windows, you may be able to export those certificates. Now, that's a lot harder with UEFI and Trusted Boot and all these other things, but we can't trust those systems. We need another layer of trust. And so we now have the ability to protect those certificates with the TPM. So you can still or export them, but they'll be encrypted and they'll be impossible to use because they can only be used on the device where they were provisioned to, because they get sent to the device and instantly encrypted and protected by the TPM. So, but Mimikatz is something that you can use with like Windows 7 devices in a number of other scenarios. So those are kind of like your four classic examples. And so what did all these breaches, what did they all bank on? Well, they all banked on the fact that a certificate that doesn't look tampered with on its surface is authentic. And so we know that's not true because we had Flame. We also believe that anything that looks like it was sent from a root certificate program organization, so all the approved CAs that get basically listed in our certificate manager, we assume those are trustworthy just because they're listed there. Well, we can't trust that. We assume that websites that show up, like that Google and Yahoo sample, that we trust those because if those are authentic certs, how could it be anybody else's? And so all this system is based on trust. And so another thing is we, of course, also assume that certs can't be ripped off PCs, and we know that's true because of Mimikatz. So the opportunity is for us to increase trust in the system, and there's two ways that we're going to do it with Windows 8.1. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to add a feature called key attestation. So the notion of attestation is basically where it can be validated that something, it could be an identity, it could be something else, can be remotely verified as being authentic and untampered with. So in the case of malware, which we'll talk about a little later, we have a concept of remote attestation where a PC can be remotely verified and we can confirm a device has integrity. We're going to have this type of concept with certificates. So with TPM key attestation, we can confirm that a certificate was securely provisioned to the PC, securely encrypted by the TPM, and then we can then verify, or a resource can then confirm when you pass your identity or your device identity or your user identity to that resource saying, hey, I'd like to authenticate and gain access to resources, it can then confirm that that certificate has been protected all the way down the path, all the way from enrollment, all the way to the TPM and the device. So that notion where you can export something and then replay it over on another PC, that doesn't work anymore with this type of technology. So this is kind of a, in a way, we know Mimikatz has been out there for a while, but that's really never been executed at scale. We think these types of attacks will be executed in scale in the future, and so this is in a way somewhat of a preemptive measure, this type of technology, to prevent this from becoming a real problem for our customers. The next area that we're going to do is we're going to try to clean up the trust of the public space. So when you go to a website, and I mentioned earlier that Google website, I mean, what can you do to defend yourself against that, right? The browser's going to show it's an authentic certificate. Everything's going to look great. There's nothing you can do on the client side to prevent being duped. What we're going to do is we're going to control things on the back end. We're going to have a cloud service that will basically crawl the web. It will collect data from the top 1 million websites. So, you know, pretty much everybody, everywhere anybody visits it with any regularity, we will take a look at their public certificates that they issue to clients that connect to them, and we're going to look at them and analyze them. We're going to make sure that they're being issued from servers that are well-known. So that scenario where the DigitoNAR scenario, those servers showed up in some country in the former, you know, Eastern Bloc. I can't remember which country, right? But with this type of technology, we would see suddenly, it's interesting, Google is issuing certificates from servers in a place that they've never done before. Our service will be able to see these type of transactions happening. And then from there, we would be able to notify Google, if that was the example. And we would be able to also work with the CAs that are issuing the certificates to promote a revocation type of action. Now, I think that Google would be responsible for asking the revocation, but we would inform whoever is affected by this. So this is really an ecosystem play. This isn't really necessarily about protecting just Windows clients. This would protect even Apple users or people using Linux, et cetera. So it's really about cleaning up the ecosystem. Another thing we'll be able to do is remember the scenario where they used a collision attack for Flame. It turns out, while on the surface that looks authentic, we can actually take a closer look within it, and we can actually tell that a different algorithm than we use, or not we, but the CA uses to create that certificate was used. We can detect that. So we can analyze even the composition of certificates. We can look at the properties, and what we found is when people try to create, you know, bogus certs, they don't do it to the level of precision, right? They maybe leave properties that have not been set. They maybe use a different algorithm because they don't know which one we're using. And so we can detect even that type of scenario. So again, this is another I wouldn't call it totally preemptive because we've seen these type of attacks in the past, but it's really about getting ahead of maybe what could feel like what we experienced with XP, right? Can you imagine if public key infrastructure experienced that type of threat? And so we think that we can get ahead of this one. So let's talk about protecting sensitive data. When it comes to protecting information, there were really kind of two things that we're doing. The first thing is related to encryption. So we did great work in Windows 8 to make sure that BitLocker was easy to provision. In Windows 8.1, we are going to deliver a new technology we had in Windows RT and also in Windows Phone 8, that device encryption, which is built on BitLocker technology. We're going to actually deliver device encryption within every edition of Windows. So regardless of which edition you have, your PC, if it's running the right hardware, meaning it has a UEFI chip, TPM, and doesn't have DMA ports, because DMA ports compromise encryption, obviously. You can steal keys out of memory. And if it is certified for connected standby, which will be what most PCs next year and the year to follow will go for that certification, we will automatically set up the encryption on the PC. So all PCs will have this technology. Now, if you want to use an alternative, you want to use Symantec or McAfee or name your favorite alternative, you can disable this functionality. But out of the box, everybody's going to be encrypted out of the box as long as they have hardware that's capable of running it. Now, the difference between BitLocker and device encryption is really just about manageability. So I think I talked about this a little bit, but the key thing is manageability. And you can instantaneously, let's say I have Enterprise Edition of Windows, and I set it up, and it's got device encryption. I want to manage it. A lot of people ask, well, do I need to convert the encryption to BitLocker? Do I need to go in through any gymnastics? The answer is no. The second you start managing it or you add additional configuration to it, it instantly kind of switches into a BitLocker mode. So there's no pain in going from device encryption. In fact, it's actually a great situation because all the heavy lifting to encrypt has already been done during setup, and so you don't have to do that provisioning process. So we're going to get into a world where all devices are encrypted out of the box. Another feature we're going to deliver with Windows 8.1 is going to give companies more control over their data. So companies are really having a difficult time with bring your own device, and once the data ends up on these devices, it's very easily leaked and it can't be revoked, et cetera, and so forth. So with Windows 8.1, we're adding a new feature called Selective Wipe, which basically enables the corporation to ensure that the data that they send to your device through email or through work folders, those are the two examples that we'll be shipping right away, That the second the relationship between the device or the user and the corporation goes away, they can pull the trigger and they can basically eliminate the data on the device. There's two ways of doing that. You can use EAS, which is a policy many or capability many people are familiar with. You can use that to wipe email. OMA-MD is a new management protocol that maybe you haven't heard of yet. This is going to be a very important protocol for manageability for non-domain joined PCs moving forward. You can use that protocol to basically trigger the wipe as well. The wipe actually really renders the data inaccessible. That's what we do at a minimum. We encrypt the data using EFS, and what we do is we really wipe the key. So the key, once it's gone, means that the data can never be decrypted. And the key is completely unrecoverable. You can never regain access once you've pulled this switch, so it is a heavy hammer, but it's important to know that the data does physically live there. So the attack on that data would be you would need to figure out how to break the encryption that's there, and there's no chance of getting the key, right? It's gone forever. So it's secure in that way, but it is important to know that the data gets left behind. Now, if you want the data to get deleted, in the case of mail, the app will implement the delete function. So selective wipe will render the data inaccessible, and then the mail app will delete it. And so it's making that decision. The reason why we don't delete the data automatically is imagine if the data was hooked up to a file replication service to the cloud. Well, what would happen is when we delete the data, it would delete the data locally, and that would then replicate to the cloud, and you would actually lose your data. And so it's important that we don't do that at a platform level. That needs to be different apps need to make that decision. That's why we don't delete the data automatically. So again, it's really important to be clear that what we're doing is we're including the mail app will have this functionality. So this requires use of a new set of APIs. What's nice about the mail app is today, even though you have EAS policy where you can delete the data, what happens is the attachments can leak outside of that container. So once they leave the container, then you don't have control on them anymore. So we've made sure that selective wipe also tags data as it's leaving any container. So saving as and these type of attachment scenarios where data kind of gets exported, so to speak, we make sure that that gets selectively wipeable marked as well. And so that kind of covers that functionality. So let's move into our malware resistance section and talk about provable PC health, which is one of our main features here. So provable PC health is really a code name for what we're still doing. We're still working on the marketing name for this. But the challenge we're trying to deal with here is that with UEFI and Trusted Boot, Flame can't be detected there, right? Because in that case here, they signed a fake bootloader with something that looked like our signature, and UEFI and Trusted Boot would never know about this, right? So we know that people will try to pull these types of things off again. And so that's one type of attack. Another attack is even though we have Trusted Boot hardening the boot process, all the way through the anti-malware solution, you can still have kernel mode drivers that start after the anti-malware driver starts. And we have this notion of polymorphic malware that can kind of constantly mutate. So sometimes it's very difficult for us to continually, I mean, it's like almost like an arms race. It's changing and then we wipe it and then change it again. And so sometimes it's very, very hard. So sometimes it really requires remote analysis of a system. And this is not remote attestation specifically, but it is very similar to that. And so what we're gonna do is we're gonna deliver a cloud-based service that will basically harvest a series of data. The data will be all the measured boot data. So measured boot is a feature of Windows 8. It takes integrity measurements of the UEFI firmware, all the option ROM firmware, all the Windows, the OS loader, every single kernel level file, the anti-malware solution, pretty much everything that starts up on the PC is measured. And these measurements represent the integrity of those. So we're gonna take those measurements is one part of it. We're also going to take measurements of any kernel mode drivers that start after the anti-malware solution. We're going to take a look at what those look like and get these integrity measurements of those. Then we're going to take a look at the action center status. So we're going to take a look at your anti-malware solution. We're going to make sure that it's running. We're going to make sure that it has the latest signatures. We're going to make sure the firewall's up and running. We're going to make sure that no tampering around these systems has occurred. We're going to take this information and we're going to send it up to the cloud. Cloud will then analyze it. And in the case of, let's say, the Flame example, where our bootloader was compromised with this fake signature, we have a database of every single version of the bootloader that we've ever shipped. And we know what the integrity measurements of each one of those are. And so when we see something that we've never shipped, that's going to be a good indicator that somebody has done something very terrible Now, that may mean that they stole an actual certificate, kind of like Stuxnet. It may mean that they did a flame and they found a way to basically do a collision attack on something, which will be very hard because we're now using SHA-2. But, you know, MD5 was pretty secure at one point, right? So we don't know what will happen next. So we'll be able to see this thing happen literally in real time. It's important to know that this feature is designed specifically in the moment to help enterprises, but it's really optimized for the consumer and the bring-your-own-device scenario. We don't have an enterprise management feature. So you can turn this off as an enterprise. I'm not sure I'd recommend doing that because I think this offers a level of protection that you probably can't do internally, and it doesn't have any performance implications that would be negative for you. In fact, that's one thing that's important is this payload of information is captured periodically, and it really almost takes no effort for the system to send it up to the cloud. So this is not like we're scanning and groveling your PC. In fact, that's another important note. We're not scanning the PC. We're looking at system components and their states and the integrity of the bits themselves. So this is not like scanning the file system looking for random things. So anyway, it's high performance, and so we encourage enterprises to run it or to allow it to be ran. But it's obviously going to be great for bringing your own device because you have those devices coming into your environment, right? And now you have a greater assurance than you've ever had that these PCs will be up to date and running the latest malware, anti-malware solution, and that they'll be secure, even if they have some of the most awful types of malware on them. The remediation process will work. Now, once we detect something in the cloud, we have an analysis and response capability that will send a message down to the client. And actually, the client actually may be Windows itself. It actually could be your cell phone as well, so we can send you text messages if we see this. So it's possible if a client was terribly infected, it might not be able to receive these messages. And so we can send information to the cell phone that you register with your MSA account. We would then provide instructions on how to remediate that particular malware. That might be using Defender Offline. If Windows can't clean it up, you may need to actually boot to a clean operating system and do a local scan to do that. You may need to run PBR to quickly refresh your system. That might be the way. So we'll give you the fastest way to get the system back to an operational healthy state. And if we detect, and this is, I think, one of the coolest parts of this feature, we effectively reverse engineer every piece of malware that we ever encounter. And we work with Symantec and McAfee and Kaspersky, and we work together on this. We don't want to duplicate efforts. We know the types of malware that have the potential to steal your identity because we know what malware does. If we think that your identity may have been stolen, we will let you know about that. And so that's a pretty cool thing. So if your MSA account has been hacked or compromised because we found a keylogger on your PC, you get to know about that. Today you would have no clue. So this is a really, really powerful feature. So let's talk about our last two capabilities, and then it looks like we're going to have time for some questions. So we're making two big improvements in Windows Defender. Two big improvements, one of which is in Windows Defender. We're going to add network monitoring behavior. So if you're familiar with anti-malware solutions, it's an arms race, and you have to, you know, new malware comes out, new signature, and then new malware, new signature. And with polymorphic malware, this is a terrible hamster type of wheel to be on. And so what we see is we see the same patterns of malicious behavior reoccurring again and again and again, right? These are not unique patterns always, although sometimes they are. You look at Flame, that was pretty unique. You look at Red October, that was unique. But most of them share the same thing. In fact, when we looked at the types of exploits on Windows 7, and we were preparing on what to do with 8, we found that there were about 26 cookbook routines on how malware would behave after it infected a PC. So there's generally nothing novel about these things, although that's not always the case. So we are adding network monitoring behavior that will be able to find familiar patterns. So even if something, a new variant of the same type of malware comes out, we would be able to block it, even though we didn't have a signature. So this is pretty cool. Next thing we're going to do is something that in some respects is surprising that we're only doing this now, actually. But again, it's all about priorities and resources. But with Internet Explorer, something a lot of people don't realize is when you go to a website and you have an ActiveX control or some binary extension that needs to be executed, that payload gets sent to your PC and it's immediately executed. So if there's a vulnerability in this ActiveX control, which sometimes is the case, you're done, right? You've already been compromised. Now, the good story is there's Defender or some third-party anti-malware solution maybe can clean that mess up. But the problem is the mess always happens and then the cleanup happens later, and we don't want that. So what we've done is we've moved the hooks, we've added hooks into the operating system, and Internet Explorer is taking advantage of it. Now what happens, the payload comes into the PC, is actually scanned before it's passed on to the ActiveX control or whatever binary extension is, so we scan it before it's executed. And, you know, I think it's like kind of a dumb moment, like, you know, why didn't you do that earlier? We've added a lot of features for a long time, and we finally got to this one. This is going to be a pretty important thing. We are kind of moving away from binary extensions, right? We now have the modern browser, the immersive browser that doesn't have these things. But there are still people who are going to use these things. Look how long it's taken from people to get the XP to Windows 7. It's been all about app compatibility. So ActiveX is not going away. And so this is going to help those users stay more secure. So that really brings us to the last slide, which is just kind of the conclusion slide. So we've added a lot of new functionality. I think it's pretty substantial for a release. I think the key things that we're making improvements are first-class biometrics experience. I mean, that is one of the big investments areas. I think the work we're doing in PKI to increase the trustworthiness of identities is somewhat an offensive move, which is kind of nice. We're no longer just doing defense. We're moving towards an offensive posture. That's, I think, really going to help us not get to that next XP type of moment. Provable PC health is going to be huge for BYOD and even consumers, and I think it's going to even be good even for enterprises. I encourage them to take a look at it, allowing this function to run. Selective wipe has been one that's been asked for forever, so we've got that for you. And I think the fact that all devices will be encrypted moving forward is a big deal as well. So that really kind of concludes the What's New in Blue presentation. So looks like we've got, I think, 10 minutes, 15 minutes of time for questions. So if there are any, feel free to ask. And then Charles, maybe we can have you come up stage here. If anybody has any questions for me or Charles, who's from Fingerprint Cards. I can't see nothing but a light bulb. Yeah, you can, sure.
There's like 20 of us here, but I'll come up to the mic. I have a question about, so we see the Windows Defender. Is that really taking all the anti-malware duties now? I guess the real question is, do we still need a third-party anti-malware solution, especially with tablets, you know, because we sort of want them as lightweight as possible.
Right. So, the question is, do you need something better than Defender? So we designed Defender to be a full-fledged anti-malware solution. Our view is no. When you look at SCEP, which is Forefront Identity Manager, the thing that you might want is you may want to use that instead, because Defender doesn't allow you to manage and do centralized reporting on what's going on and provisioning of signatures and whatnot. So SCEP would give you control, but I think for like a consumer, if we're thinking about just that scenario or a BYOD, Defender is a great solution. There was an article, you know, maybe some of you are going, I know that's not true, Chris. There was an article that said that's not true. I'll just put it out there. There was an article, I think it might have been 6 months ago, where somebody said, oh, the competition detected X percent more malware. And so the thing I would encourage you to think about is, yeah, that percentage was true, but as we all know, because we're all smart here, we know sometimes the way you look at a statistic makes things look worse than it really is. And so if you're familiar with the story I'm talking about, we have another statistic you might look at instead. When we compare ourselves versus the competition, we detected there was 0.02% of the malware that was basically used in this battery of tests was not detected by us. So, you know, less than 1%. So, in other words, we did pretty good, yeah. So compared to everybody else as a percent, yeah, they detected more, but it was like 0.02 of our customers were affected by that. And so our answer is we prioritize not going after those specific bits of malware because they were not even pervasive. I mean, they were random things that were maybe regional and maybe had low impact, and so we didn't put them in our suite. But with that said, we did take the message, and we're like, hey, you know, we shouldn't be as good as the competition, and so we're gonna catch up to make sure that we don't have that 0.02%. So anyway, hopefully that answered the question.
It did. Thank you.
No problem. Any other questions? Okay, go ahead. So they're going to disclose vulnerabilities
so
in their own.
That,
Oh, okay.
If they run across a vulnerability, typically they give a third party, you know, six, like Adobe or whatever, they let them know the vulnerability and they wait 60 days. And that's pretty standard industry practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I hate to deflect a question, but I would like you to ask Google that. Like, what's the benefit of that? I mean, they should let us know immediately, right? Because we want to take action. We want to.
You know, and then they'll probably announce it within 7 days.
Yeah, I don't know why that they would want to do that. I think that when it comes to vulnerabilities, right, the reality is it doesn't matter how good your software practices are, vulnerabilities will happen, and I don't see the benefit of disclosing something in advance of a company being able maybe to prepare against that by delivering a patch. So, I would like to know more about what their objective is there. Do you have an opinion on it?
I go back and forth. You know, I mean, if it's a real vulnerability, I would want to know sooner rather than later. But at the same time, if it's not actively being exploited, you have to give the vendor time to patch it.
I mean, if it's
Yeah, I think that that's the key thing right there, is if it's actively being exploited, then the world should know.
Even if it's not actively being exploited, they've just discovered it on them, with their own tools or whatever.
Yeah.
How are they exploiting them? I mean, they've got their own security team and all that stuff, but looking old just like you guys are doing.
Yeah, I don't know who that's benefiting. I think it's actually hurting, because there's companies need time to analyze the threat, patch it, test it, provision it. So if you basically tell everybody to go, hey, here's an exploit, go start writing malicious software for it, I don't see the benefit of that. So, yeah. So anyway, we should probably work together better on that one. Any other questions? Go ahead. This is a great question, and it's really an omission in my deck. I should probably have a slide just on that, because I think a lot of people are sensitive to this. So a couple things that are important to know about biometrics. Your biometric identity is not stored in the cloud. So it's not in Active Directory, not somewhere that's central. It's on the device itself. So this addresses most people's initial concern that my biometric identity is going to be used, and maybe somebody could use it in some way. So that's part one. The biometric identity that we do capture with the device is protected. It can be protected in software. It can even be protected in hardware to create the condition where it never even is really accessed directly by even Windows. Charles, maybe you can add to that. So there's similar concepts to what we do. Remember I talked about the ability to use the TPM as a way to protect a certificate to prevent it from being exportable. Those same type of policies apply to the templates to make sure that they can't be exported and replayed. Is that central? So we think that we've addressed the privacy concerns, but I think we should get ahead of on the messaging. So thanks for that feedback. I should put that in the deck right up front. Go ahead, question in the back. You probably know more about that. I mean, there are things in there to help, but Charles probably knows the technology better than I.
It actually
Yeah, there's a mic in the mill room. Yeah.
Well, I work on my yard a lot. And sometimes, you know, when you repair your PCV, I have those screws on my finger. And I can still able to capture my prints. Okay. So what we do is, when Chris at first, when he showed you that particular unit, that is only a prototype, okay, surrounding that silicon, surrounding those pixels, you see the metallic, right. So the way that it works is, when you put your finger onto the pixel, your finger would touch the metal, okay? And then what we do is we actually inject a minor current into your finger. You will not be able to feel it. So that particular current is going to enhance the image. So I would not be able to show you. It actually captures a 3D image. So when you put your finger onto our silicon, it literally see a 3D, you know, image of your print. It even see the pore. So it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, for you to duplicate it, because most of the time when you're trying to spoof the system, you capture a 2D image, okay? So what we do is a capacitive technology, number one. We inject a current into your finger, we capture a 3D image, okay? And then we take that template and digitize it. In the meantime, we're working with Microsoft, Intel and other companies, even TPM, right? So we're going step by step to integrate a lot of other pieces of the components to make this into a very secure environment.
Thanks.
Thanks, Charles. And Charles is going to be probably floating around the Microsoft booth with me tonight. And would you be able to bring that software so they can see the 3D? If you want to see what this three-dimensional look has, he'll have software that shows what your imprint looks like. And actually, you're going to be surprised how many cuts you have on your fingers that you don't even know about. Yeah, my fingerprints look like, it'd be interesting to see what a mechanic's fingerprint looks like. It's probably shredded.
I saw their keyboards, you know what I was talking about. I mean, it's like there's an inch of grease, so dirt, you know, so I just wonder. It seems like a great idea.
Yeah.
That is actually, in another way, is software can do a lot of things, right? So now, the technology is supposed to be for everyone to use, even small trials. And sometimes their finger continue to grow, right? Our finger changed too. So the system would be able to continue to capture and store that image. So it would continue to improve, okay? And I think one of the reason before, you know, a lot of people say, even Chris said, I doubt there's 20% of the people is using biometric fingerprint sensor. It was so hard to use when you use a swipe. And it's not the technology is not working correctly. It's when you put your finger there, you did not put your finger correctly. Okay? It turned out that the interesting part of your finger is only in the middle of the finger. So the side, the tip, those are not very interesting information that we want. So if you do that, then that's why the system rejecting you. Okay, most people are impatient. When if I swipe more than one time, I would say, well, this darn thing doesn't work. I don't want to use it anymore. But with this newer touch sensor, and you basically just put your finger there, this system continues to scan until it's happy. So it would tell you, no, this is the wrong finger, or that's it. Okay, so when we work with Microsoft, one of the things that they said was, man, when I was using the swipe sensor, sometimes, you know, I literally have to enroll my finger, I might have to do 10 times, 11 times. And some people, if they have very shallow prints, even longer. But with the touch sensor, you don't. You just put your finger there, and it will capture you. Okay. So if you have time, I can show it to you. You would be surprised, amazed.
So I'm going to run out. We're running a little late, but I have time for, I think, was there a question in the very back there? I thought I saw a hand back there earlier. Okay, maybe one more. Okay, let's do this one, and then we'll have to wrap it up. And then we can meet at the booth if anything comes up later tonight. Go ahead.
So first off, it looks like there's a lot of great things that you guys are doing. But there's one, I guess, attack vector that I see common that I'm concerned about.
Okay.
And it's in user mode.
It's in what, in user mode?
In user mode.
Okay,
so
sure.
If we're writing an app that's going to rely on a biometric signature, and that comes back through just a standard API, and I guess it goes again to the kind of stuff I was asking before, what if someone's just swapping out that function, and we're trying to return a value if it's true or false? Well, what do we have in place that's stopping someone from swapping the function address and just returning true every time?
So if there was a vulnerability in the system and somebody could replace the code in memory as it's running to always show true, that would be game over for biometrics.
I see that a lot at large enterprises, and a lot of times it's not malicious software, but it's pretty commonly done by some other major vendors.
So my response to that would be is the things that we've done in DEP and ALSR are probably significant enough that that's going to be an extremely hard thing to pull off. I don't want to say vulnerabilities are no longer relevant, because that would be a dumb thing for a security person to say, but if you look at the level of sophistication that it takes to defeat ALSR on Windows 8, compare that to 7. It's a magnitude of order. I mean, it's like we're now dealing with a memory address space that's 64-bit, right, number one, whereas before we really didn't take advantage of that from an ALSR perspective. We now have DEP being applied everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to find executable code, a place where there only executable code can to put your malware in. And so I don't want to say that's not going to happen, but I feel pretty good about our defenses on that threat.
My bigger concern is just users installing stuff themselves, and then afterwards not even needing UAC to do that. If that was something that you could protect with UAC, I think it would be really useful to know, hey, you have an app that wants to replace your function tables, prompt the user.
Well, the problem with this attack is a user mode app really doesn't go replace things in memory, right? So what you're really dealing with, a vulnerability where somebody's buffer overrunning and inputting something into memory. And so UAC could never see that because it's a vulnerability. So, but I see what you're saying, but I feel pretty good about our defenses in this area. So I'm sleeping easy on that one, but it still is a potential option. If somebody can get around ALSR in its new level of sophistication and insert something that always returns true on biometric, it's all over, absolutely.
Well, I guess I'm wondering how that would be affected by ASLR. Since I'm not actually talking about a buffer overflow, it's just legitimate kernel 32 functions let you do this. Because what you don't actually do is overwrite the memory, you just change the pointer address. So you write in a pointer somewhere else.
Well, I think the scenario you're talking about is where a process goes and tries to overwrite a memory address of Windows. So
kernel mode, just in its own process space.
Right. So a process's ability to do that is pretty low, right? So you have so this process would have to be running at the highest level of integrity to be able to overwrite a memory address of Windows in the first place. So it's very difficult for.
Is that new in Windows 8? Because
no,
I know
around,
you can do
that's
that.
Been around since Vista. Well, anyway, I think that, I don't want to cut you off. I do need to move to the next thing, but we can talk more about this. But again, I think that there's some valid concerns there, but our defenses that are in place are making that more theoretical than a likely attack. I think we're pretty good there.
I guess I know our software and Citrix both do it without user mode elevation in Windows.
Yeah, the way the system is designed and been designed for a while, your ability is another process that's running to be able to overwrite the memory of another process
and
insert is not there.
My bigger concern is someone tricking the user into adding something into app and not being allowed to write it whenever the process starts up without using
it. Yeah, well, again, I'm not trying to cut you off. I have another interview. I do have to go to it, but I would love to talk to you more about this because when we have more time, we can probably really isolate the problem set a little better. So anyway, with that, thanks for attending today's session. I appreciate it. I hope you're excited about the security features because, as you said, I agree. There's substantial, I think, set of improvements. And if you have any more questions, I'd love to talk to you tonight while we have maybe a beer or two. So thank you.